evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It is reported the U.S. used white phosphorus in attack in Syria. It is reported that two U.S. jets have bombed a town in the Syrian Deir ez-Zor province with white phosphorus munitions, causing massive fires, Russian military has said. Two F-15 jets on Saturday bombed the town of Hajin with white phosphorus incendiary munitions banned under the Geneva Convention. A Pentagon spokesman denied the allegations of dropping white phosphorus bombs. Quote, "At this time, we have not received any reports of any use of white phosphorus. None of the military units in the area are even equipped with white phosphorus munitions of any kind," according to Commander Sean Robinson. The U.S. military says it doesn't use white phosphorus as a weapon, but it has previously been accused of not being entirely forthcoming on the matter. After being accused of using the munitions in Iraq in 2005, the U.S. State Department said the substance had only been used as a signaling device. But confronted with evidence, the military later admitted it had used it as an incendiary weapon. The real takeaway from this story is that the fight for Idlib has begun. Idlib is the last barrier standing between the Syrian government and its military victory against the rebellion that began more than 7 years ago. Amid persisting uncertainty, three scenarios are likely to emerge: a massive onslaught, a protracted offensive, or infighting between rebels followed by a reconciliation deal with Damascus. But whatever happens, it'll be the civilians currently trapped in that densely populated space that will pay the highest price. The U.S. is backing the rebels. That's called being on the wrong side of history. Trump administration to close PLO office in Washington. The United States will shut the PLO diplomatic office in Washington, D.C. over the Palestinian government's refusal to enter into U.S.-led negotiations with Israel. Quote, "We've been notified by a U.S. official of their decision to close the Palestinian mission to the U.S., PLO Secretary General Saeed Erekat said in a statement earlier today. It comes after the White House moved recently to cut aid from humanitarian services in Palestine, and the U.S. recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. The U.S. is also upset by efforts to get Israel investigated for war crimes by the International Criminal Court. Trump's National Security Advisor John Bolton will also reportedly threaten the International Court with sanctions if it carries out investigations into the U.S. and Israel. How can anyone expect the Palestinian government to enter into U.S.-led negotiations with Israel when the U.S. has gone above and beyond existing U.S. policy and demonstrated its allegiance to and with the Zionists in Israel? Perjury complaint against Brett Kavanaugh to be heard by Merrick Garland. Donald Trump's most recent Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, is facing perjury complaints for his testimony before Congress during the Senate hearing for his confirmation. The Democratic coalition, in their initial complaint, alleges that Kavanaugh's testimony, not only in this hearing but in other testimony before Congress, includes false statements about certain documents said to be stolen from Democratic members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here's the real irony. The complaint will now be heard by none other than Merrick Garland, President Obama's pick for the Supreme Court, who was denied a hearing. Dallas police officer arrested days after she killed a man in his own apartment. Amber Geiger, 30 years old, was taken into custody Sunday evening amid testifying and intensifying calls for her arrest and accusations that police are showing differential treatment to one of their own. The Dallas police officer, who authorities said entered an apartment she thought was hers and killed a man who lived there, is now facing a manslaughter charge. The victim was shot Thursday in his apartment building near downtown Dallas. Geiger, still in uniform after working a shift, went inside Mr. Jean's apartment, thinking it was hers, police said. Officers have said little else about what happened. You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. The Labor Department released its monthly hiring and unemployment figures for the month of August on Friday. Wages were 2.9% higher in August from a year ago and the fastest rate of growth since June of 2009. What's really behind these numbers, and what do they mean to the average American? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. She's a labor economist, noted author, commentator, and consultant. She served as the 15th president of Bennett College for Women, and her latest book is Are We Better Off? Race, Obama, and Public Policy. She is Dr. Julianne Malveaux. Welcome to The Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer. It's great to be with you.
A pleasure to have you. So, President Trump wants us to believe that he is responsible for the so-called booming economy. Your thoughts?
Really? But the most fascinating thing about this is that this man that wouldn't know the truth if it slapped him upside the head. President Obama, speaking on Friday, was very eloquent in talking about what the roots of this economic expansion have been. And we have been in economic expansion since 2009. We've seen economic growth every month since 2009, every quarter since 2009. Mr. 45, I'm trying to keep it clean.
Mm-hmm.
Show.
Thank you.
So, Mr. 45 has not done anything that's exceptional. But there are a couple things that we have to do. You know, I was with a friend this morning talking about these numbers. I get excited when I look at the unemployment numbers the first Friday of every month. We saw an unemployment rate of 3.9%, but for, of course, African-Americans. For whites, it was 3.4. For African-Americans, we're looking at 6%. We look at a number of things that look strong. As an example, we see more people leaving jobs. Wilmer, leaving jobs than we've seen in the past 6 months. So when people start leaving jobs, it means that they feel confident that they have opportunities. So we have job leavers. But the 3.9 turns into 7.4. We look at all the people who are not there. They're we call residual employees.
In fact, you're taking me right to my next question. As a labor economist, we hear about the domestic labor market added 201,000 jobs last month and the unemployment rate held at 3.9. But that's not the real picture of who's working in this country and who's not. Could you quickly explain the U3 number, which is the number that gets touted most often, versus the U6 number, which I think is what you're about to refer to?
Well, no, the U6 number, you're talking about the employment population ratio. What percentage of the population is actually working? So while the unemployment rate number is interesting, the bigger number is who's working.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look at, let's just use men because women are different for any number of reasons, but with white men, you're looking at 69% of white men are working. For black men, it's 62%. So that's a huge gap.
Right.
So what's going on? And then when you go into certain cities, Wilmer, as you know, we go into a Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
D.C., a Baltimore.
Oakland.
Oakland, New York City.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at something like 54%, 55%, which means what? Half of all adult black men are not working. And so that's a number that we have to pay attention to. When we add to that a series of questions about, as I said, the 3.9 turns into 7.4, and then for black people turns into 12%. So 1 in 8 black persons who wants to work is not finding work. So we are not having a party. We're not dancing the electric slide because this man has told a bunch of lies. Who else has 4,600 Pinocchios with the Washington Post. Put this as yet another Pinocchio. Now, I'll say this. The economy is stronger than it was 3 years ago, but that's because of the foundation that President Obama laid. So, yes, the economy is stronger, but no economic growth, and we've seen economic growth every quarter. Mr. Orangutan, he talked about 4% in the first quarter, and we saw something slower, like 3-something percent in the second quarter. We're going to end the year with about a 2.5%, maybe even a 3% growth rate, but the fruits of the growth have not trickled down. So Pookie ain't feeling it. Tamika ain't feeling it.
And I think to that insinuation or to that point, what's also not being discussed is poverty in this country. 1 in 8 households struggles to put food on the table. 77 million people live in communities where the poverty rates of 20% are of 20% or higher. 1 million veterans live below the poverty line.
These people don't want to use the term poverty. And indeed, what they've done is they've monetized poverty. What I mean by that is that if you steal a loaf of bread and your bail is $10,000, that means somebody in your family has to come up with $1,000. But if you stole a loaf of bread, you would not need somebody to come up, $1,000. So basically, there's a sister, her name is Kelly Hernandez out of UCLA, and she's doing work around, has a great grant to do work around how poverty and incarceration are monetized in the majority community. In other words, there are precincts in parts of L.A. where, because you've been incarcerated, you have now done an income transfer to the more wealthy parts of L.A.
And explain that welfare transfer.
Okay, again, here's the brother who stole the loaf of bread. Now, brother man stays in jail for how many days, how many weeks?
Because he can't pay bail, which is why people now are trying to do away with monetary bail.
So if he stays in jail that time, whoever manages the incarceration unit is getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if he is able to come up with bail, whoever runs the bail bonds thing is getting paid. Here's the bottom line. Ain't nobody in his community, excuse my Ebonics, but I speak English, ain't nobody in his community getting paid. So basically, you're having a wealth transfer from a poor community to a wealthier community because somebody has tried to feed their family.
So as a labor economist, when you look at the tax cuts that Donald Trump has given to corporate America, as you look at this trade war that Donald Trump is engaging with the world, what do you really see at the practical working level as a labor economist with work in this country?
What you see is a economy that's bifurcated. As President Obama said on Friday, he is not the cause of this. He's an outcome of this. This has been a situation that's been happening for a very long time. President Obama, in calling him out, really probably should have called himself out too.
No question.
But there are things he could have done that he didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line is this. We basically have people who are being forced to the periphery of society, not of the labor market, but of society, forced to the periphery because they're not opportunities for them. And the reason why we have not seen wages go up, and this, Wilmer, is the thing that's the most egregious thing about all this, is that wages have not risen. So you have a lower unemployment rate, 3.9%. Labor economists all over the country say 3.9%, this is full employment. But it's not full employment when you have flat wages. And you have flat wages because employers know that people are still desperate for work. And so employers know that you can hire somebody for the same wages you had them for a year ago. In a really tight labor market, you hear people saying, we're looking for workers. Well, if you're really looking for workers and you really feel impressed, raise wages.
So what? Quickly, we have just about 2 minutes left. What are the type of jobs? And Donald Trump keeps telling us that He's going to bring manufacturing back to the United States. He's going to bring jobs back to the United States, as though the 1950s are going to come back. And I just don't see that happening.
No, in fact, when you look at manufacturing and everything that's around manufacturing, this is why this tariff thing that he's doing is deleterious. In fact, it's cheaper to manufacture in China, in Thailand, in Lesotho, South Africa. It's cheaper to manufacture in those places than in the United States. You can pay people less. But once those goods and services have come here, we need workers to do things like sort the work, distribute the work, all of those things. Manufacturing is not coming back, and he can't make it come back. You saw the Harley situation where they said, if you put tariffs on this stuff, we got to go.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that has to do with aluminum and steel, slapping tariffs is only going to make it more easy for people to leave. What we have to look at is the way in a global society we do what economists call comparative advantage. You do what you're best at, and I'll do what I'm best at, and we try to have flows of goods and services. And so this man has resisted that because he resists anything that makes sense. And we are going to end up with a situation where world GDP, world product will drop if you impose too many tariffs on the wrong people.
Dr. Julianne Malveau, how can people who are interested in your work and interested in contacting you as a consultant, how can people contact Dr. Julianne Malveau?
dr.j@julianmalveau.com. That's dr.j@julianmalveau.com. My website has some of my columns, other things, and I am available. I'd love to talk, write, raise hell, and get paid for some of it.
There we go. Dr. Julianne Malveau, thank you so much for your time, so much for coming on the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Dr. Wilbur Leon. Appreciate you.
You got it. All right, folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Judge orders accused Russian agent Maria Butina to remain in jail, even though the government erred in claiming Ms. Butina offered to trade sex for political access. What's going on with the prosecution's case, and how is it that even though the prosecution knowingly misrepresented their claim, Ms. Butina languishes in jail? For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a journalist and writer at Sputnik News, Alex Rubenstein. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, man, thank you for your work. Thank you. So you were at the courthouse today. What's going on with this trial?
So, I mean, it didn't seem to play into today's trial, to today's hearing too much, that the government had to walk back these claims. However, the judge did speak to it very briefly, and she really admonished the prosecution over this. I mean, she said that they were basically starting off the case by making very salacious arguments against the client, and was tainting the jury pool and made it hard for her to get a fair trial in the district. One thing she said was that the messages that the government was basing this sex claim on, it took her 5 minutes of review of those messages to realize that they were jokes, that they were done in jest.
If the judge sits on the bench and makes that observation, and part of the hearing had to do with bail, how then does the judge decide that Ms. Butina should stay in jail?
Well, real quickly, she said, actually, another thing she said about this charge was that she was dismayed and concerned that a member of the Department of Justice or the U.S. Attorney's Office had seen these messages and decided that they should be taken at face value. Now, so she basically upheld a prior ruling by another judge, Judge Robinson, who basically argued that if Butina was released on bail, then she would pose a flight risk that can't be resolved. Basically, the government's theory in arguing for denying bond was that Butina could, for example, get into a car with diplomatic plates and be taken to an airport, and that U.S. law enforcement would be powerless to do anything about it. Now, I don't know how you square that with the fact that once she's outside of the diplomatic vehicle and in the airport, she's still within U.S. jurisdiction. But the defense is, you know, argued repeatedly that, you know, Butina has had a number of opportunities to flee the United States. She could have fled when she was first accused of being an unregistered foreign agent by the media. And then she could have been accused. She could have fled when she had to testify in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And she could have fled after the FBI raided her home with their guns drawn. But in all of those cases, she didn't. And so the defense's argument has basically been, look, Butina is exceptional in that she's shown that she's going to, face the wind here. Nonetheless, the judge did not allow for the motion for bond to proceed. One thing that was actually really interesting was the judge Tanya S. Chutkan. She basically argued that the number of statements that have come out from the Russian government. Now, she didn't say whom, but, you know, it's the foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, and the Russian embassy. The number of those statements indicates a possible relationship between her. And so, you know, the inference there is that basically Russia isn't allowed to stick up for its own people. I can't think of a single country that if guilty or innocent, if one of their nationals is accused of being an unregistered foreign agent, and more widely in the press, although it's not substantiated, of being a spy, they're going to stick up for that person. And so I don't see that as controversial. I mean, I've also seen reporters on Twitter, you know, trying to raise controversy around the fact that members of the Russian embassy are there. You know, they're speaking in Russian or they're talking to the defense. Of course they're talking to the defense. There's no controversy there. It's par for the course.
So part of this argument about being a flight risk seems to be kind of a circular argument, and that is they claim she's a spy, but it was just disproven that some of the evidence that they used to say she was a spy is fictional.
Right.
But I'm still going to say she's a flight risk because she's a spy.
Right, right. Well, so just to be clear, I mean, this is a fair an assessment, but just to be clear, she's not charged with espionage. She's charged with acting as an unregistered foreign agent and conspiring to act as an unregistered foreign agent, which is a 15-year sentence, but it's not espionage, so she's not accused of spying. Nonetheless, mainstream media all over the place.
I use that term very loosely.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. You know, the other thing, too, is that, you know, just hours before the hearing today, ABC News got an exclusive. They published an exclusive, and they said that they got dozens of pages of Butina's email correspondence from past couple of years exclusively. So where'd they get that from? Well, somebody leaked it, I would assume, right? One would assume, because it's not public information. Nonetheless, so ABC is running with this, with these leaks. And today what happens is the judge gags the defense attorney. And she said that, you know, he's been opining on the case, which he's not allowed to do. But And talking about the weight of the evidence, like the substance of the. So here's the thing. He's been pushing back on these false claims that the government has made. And she said, you know, even the government bears some responsibility in this. Nonetheless, he's gagged, and it's going to be a situation where the information that we get out of this case that's not done in court or not done in public motions are going to be leaks from the government. And that's unfortunate.
Isn't it also early in this, she was accused of fleeing, but actually what she was doing was moving from one apartment to another apartment?
Right. So they were afraid that she was going to take off to another country. And actually what she had done was rent a U-Haul truck because she was planning on moving in with her boyfriend in South Dakota. I don't know how you can get to Russia in a U-Haul truck. Apparently,
let's see, if I go to Alaska, because Sarah Palin can see Russia from her backyard, and then I drive across the Bering Strait, can I get there?
I don't think so.
All right.
And the other thing too was that the government said that she took out a visa, a tourist visa, and was planning to leave. But actually, in a motion filed over the weekend, I believe, by the defense, they said, look, this is not a tourist visa. This is a work visa to spend another year in the United States working here. And so that was another piece of information that was put forth as a reason for a flight risk, which has been demolished.
What's behind all this? Well, I mean, 3 months ago, and I'm being I mean, I don't remember when the story broke. I had no idea who this woman was. Why? What's behind all this?
I mean, I think it plays into the larger narrative of anti-Russia hysteria. I mean, if you look at the facts of when the case broke, so she was arrested on July 15th. The Justice Department didn't announce that she was arrested until the day later. What was the day later? That was when Trump was in Helsinki, Finland, meeting with the evil Russian President Vladimir Putin. And so while this is not part of the Mueller probe at all, it's totally separate from it, that's how it's being construed in the mainstream media. And it's part of this overall anti-Russian narrative. And it's really sick and unfortunate what they've done to this woman's character. Even the judge said this was a smear against her reputation. It hurt her family. And it's totally unfair. And it's deeply troubling because here's the thing. It's Washington, D.C. You know, most people here work in nonprofits. People that work in nonprofits here, they go through, you know, training, quote unquote, on how to not get hacked by the Russians. And people who work in the government are also trained to hate the Russians. And so D.C. has an extremely limited jury pool. So these leaks from the prosecution and even the facts of the FBI affidavit themselves, her being a Russian national in itself is almost criminal in the district, right?
So what's the connection then with her and the NRA? And the reports that I read earlier was she's trained with a gun since she was a child. Her father taught her how to shoot, and she started a NRA type organization in Russia. I still don't understand. I understand very clearly what you're saying, but it's so crazy to me that the government would pick someone like this to just construct this whole narrative based upon his hysteria. It just boggles my mind.
Well, I think part of that is this larger context around the NRA, and I'm not endorsing the NRA. I'm not a fan. However, the Democrats have been putting out this line since the shooting in Parkland that, you know, the NRA basically supports baby killer, child killers, right? And so if you have a Russian enemy number one in bed with the NRA enemy number two, you have a strong enemy right there. But she's a longtime gun rights activist in Russia. Personally, I see her as somebody who is trying to make U.S.-Russian connections stronger, you know, improve relations. They say that she was working at the behest of a Kremlin insider. You know, his name is Alexander Torshin. He's an official at a Russian bank. But I mean, if you look at the substance of the messages between the two, which were sent over Twitter direct message, not like a spy to spy.
Encrypted Twitter.
Right, right.
Heavily encrypted Twitter.
So, you know, one thing that the government has said is like, well, she asked Torshin, you know, what are my orders? Which, wow, sound the alarms. What are my orders? But, you know, that could have been said in jest, too. I mean, you have to wonder after this sex allegation fell apart, how many other messages were willfully misinterpreted?
Well, in fact, that was my next question. Once the judge during the hearing has basically torn up that element, what else do they have?
Well, I mean, there's this, what are my orders? She was followed by the FBI for quite some time and they were surveilling her, taking pictures. And she supposedly met with a man who is believed to be a member of the FSB. And they had dinner together, and he was one of the diplomats who was expelled by Obama, I believe, over the whole Russian meddling thing, which was, you know, not like a targeted expulsion. It was like, we're just going to expel a bunch of your people. So, right. And then, you know, the other thing too is, so while they like really try to drive home these, you know, what are my orders, or Torshin telling her, oh, you're bigger than Anna Chapman or something, what they're not looking at in these messages are things like, oh, how do I buy toothpaste in America? Oh, what would your kids like from America for Christmas? You know, these kinds of things which show that her relationship to this official was one of friendliness, one of shared interest, not on behalf of the Kremlin, but they were both gun rights activists.
But if Christmas is code for So where do you see this going now from what you experience and witness today? Are you able to glean any idea of where this is going?
It's really hard to tell. I've been saying for a while that based off the FBI affidavit alone, which came out on July 16, I could see a DC jury convicting her. Not because she's guilty beyond reasonable doubt, but because she's a Russian and, you know, the substance of the spying and, you know, the sexy claims and whatnot.
It's just real quick. It's also interesting to me that the sex allegation was put in there because that it seems almost stereotypical in terms of so-called spies or agents and so on and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. It's salacious. It's sexy. It's like a spy thriller. You know, it's really almost a parody of itself. And it's really actually, you know, I think what's missed here is that it's really misogynist, and it's also, I think, anti-Slav. I think there's this trope about Slavic people being willing to go to such extreme lengths to, you know, really undermine whatever it is they're trying to undermine. And I think that's really disgusting and overlooked. I'd like to see this case showing the truth about Butina's messages. And I think that truth is that she's innocent. However, I don't know that a DC jury is going to find that. And meanwhile, a trial date has not been set yet. Her next status hearing is November 13.
Do you get a sense that the judge would be strong enough to say, there's no here, throw this whole thing out?
The judge seems like she sticks to the rules. She on one hand today, really chastised the government for making these false claims at the outset, which is, you know, an important fact here because, you know, maybe somebody reads about Butina once 3 months ago and then they get selected on the jury pool. Not everyone's, you know, reading up on the day to day there. But she also gagged the defense over opining on the case, which is, you know, I think that's pretty absurd. So she seems like a fair judge. I haven't seen too much of her. I saw two status hearings with the same judge. So we'll have to see where it goes.
Real quick, Alex, because you do great work, where can people find more of what you do?
You can find me on Twitter at Real Alex Ruby. That's R-U-B-I.
Real Alex Ruby on Twitter.
On Twitter.
Hey, man. Great work as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Wow. Well, there's obviously more in this, more in store on this one. So please, please, please stay tuned. Well, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Many apologists for the Bush administration's illegal and immoral invasion of Iraq blame the invasion on bad intelligence. My question has always been, how can you blame the invasion on bad intel when you created the office to develop and disseminate bad intel? Also, are we still being victimized by the same process? For insight in this, we turn to my next guest. She's an American activist and commentator. She's a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel whose assignments included duties as a Pentagon desk officer and, I believe, in the Office of Special Plans and a variety of roles for the National Security Agency, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force retired Karen Kwiatkowski. Karen, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. I actually, my job was in the sister office to the Office of Special Plans. That small group was pulled from the larger office that I worked in. So I got to see it in its pre-formation days, during its formation, and then, of course, after it was formed, doing exactly what you just described.
Great. Then please explain to the audience because some who may not remember, how the Office of Special Plans was created by Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith and headed by Feith under then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld to supply the Bush administration officials with raw intelligence, what they did, how they did it, and its impact.
Yeah, well, they were formed, as you said, and the actual intelligence coming from the professional intelligence agencies, the Defense Intelligence Agency, even the CIA, certainly the State Department Bureau of Intelligence, this information was not compelling to produce any type of justification for an invasion of Iraq. Because what they were telling him was, there's no connection. 9/11 had no connection. Saddam Hussein, no connection. Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, no connection. This is what the intelligence is telling them. So that wasn't good enough. They needed something more compelling. So they formed this group, which had access at the highest levels of clearance to all the intelligence that was out there, plus the raw data. And, of course, we remember it's not just the Pentagon, but, you know, Dick Cheney going to the CIA, talking to actual analysts and pressuring them to tell him something that he could use or something that he wanted to hear. Well, that's what these guys were doing inside the Pentagon, producing the story. And the way they did it, of course, is to take out of context data bits, some totally unrelated, some unverified, some actually known to be false, but they just left that part off, and they put it all together and then recycle it back into the intelligence system, back into reports that would land at the National Security Council, reports that would actually land on the president's desk, certainly into reports like the infamous one that Secretary Powell read or presented to the UN Security Council, which I would say at least 50% of that was creative fantasy on the part that can be traced directly back to the Office of Special Plans and their cohorts in CIA and National Security Council. So creative intelligence. It's not intelligence. It's not factual, but it is a story. And it happened to be a compelling story, politically compelling, because of the people we had leading this country at that time. And I think that's what we're seeing in a similar way today.
In fact, I want to get to that point, but you mentioned Colin Powell's report to the UN Security Council. And I remember right after General Powell gave that report, it came out that there was a doctoral student named Ibrahim al-Marashi, who was an Iraqi national, and that they had taken part of his doctoral dissertation and some of the questions that he was posing and turned those questions into fact and inserted that into Powell's speech. And then I called and interviewed Ibrahim al-Marashi.
Did you?
I did. About a week after the report came out.
Okay.
And he was scratching his head saying, A, I don't know how they got a hold of my dissertation, and B, he said they took issues and questions I was posing and transposed them and asserted them as fact.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of creative propaganda, I think, is done in translation. You know, take something out of context, mistranslate something, and there was a lot of that. One of the guys I work with, shared the same office space with me, was a translator. So he would look at Arabic news and other things that were written in different languages, especially with Arabic, but there were other languages that they looked at, Farsi, of course, and take and mistranslate or alternatively translate into English what some newspaper said, and then all of a sudden now you have a factoid that shows up as some justification for war, because that's what that was their agenda. They wanted to invade Iraq. They wanted to topple Saddam Hussein. The first thing they did after they took over was nationalize under the U.S. the oil production of Saddam Hussein. So, I mean, you know, we had an agenda. We had a plan. We just had to lie to get it, to get the American people to go along with it, because the real reasons couldn't have been sold. And I think even Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld later admitted that the real reasons weren't that interesting to the American people. So we needed some reasons that would get them excited.
And I also remember very clearly shortly after the attacks of September 11th, President Bush was on television saying, the American people want us to bomb somebody. And I even had people calling into the show I was doing at the time saying, I don't care who we bomb, we've got to bomb somebody. They were looking for almost like any port in a storm.
Well, sure. That's, and this is kind of more of a philosophical problem when you think about this country. We were a big country with 310 million people and whatnot, but our ideas that we are exceptional and that we don't do anything wrong, and anybody who does something wrong against us, it must be the devil and must be motivated by something simply pure evil. No rationality, because we don't see ourselves as the rest of the world sees us. And so when we get attacked or have something, all you need to do to the American people is present them with an enemy, and the American people will have righteous indignation. because we've not really studied our own history. We don't really understand our foreign policy as it is has evolved and as it's practiced. We don't know that. Most Americans are really unaware of what Washington, D.C. conducts across the planet. We have no idea.
You were getting ready to talk about the correlation between what you experienced in the Pentagon, in the Office of Special Plans and its sister office, and where we are today. Go ahead, please, with that. I mean, as you listen to discussions regarding the Iran nuclear deal, the use of chemical weapons in Syria, or what's happening in Yemen, do these stories sound eerily reminiscent?
Well, in a lot of ways, they do. Certainly, we're not hearing a lot about Yemen. Only recently has it even popped up, and Yemen's been going on for some time. That's because our ally, Saudi Arabia, is prosecuting that with our consent and with our supplies, including military supplies. So that's an example of where something bad is happening that we're not seeing in the American media. But the continued demonization of Assad in Syria, and of course Iran is the grand puppet master of the Middle East. This storyline and the news bits that we're hearing has been a kind of a drumbeat, and the people behind it in the Trump administration, probably to about 80% of them, are the exact same individuals by name that I worked with, okay, and that became infamous after the invasion of Iraq when it turned out, hey, actually, they were lying. Who were they? Well, they were the neocons. Who are they? We named their names. Those guys have recycled back into the Trump administration.
Give us some examples of specifically who you're talking about.
Well, John Bolton is the National Security Council advisor. He's the third or fourth one that Trump has had, but he hired him back in, I think, January. So he hasn't been fired yet. This is very alarming. I mean, you know, the one thing about Trump is he fires people, things, one day he tweets this, one day he tweets that. In some ways, that can keep really bad things from happening. But he hasn't fired John Bolton yet. So John Bolton is a prime example. A number of people that John Bolton has brought up were my old boss. My old boss is Bill Luty, I think, is up there. Doug Feith has a job in the administration, either as an advisor or directly. Myra Wormser and her husband are both have contracts with the National Security Council. These people worked hard to create propaganda war that preceded the real invasion of the invasion of Iraq. Okay, same people exactly 15 years later, they're doing the exact same thing. But the difference is, before they did it, and they had Cheney and they had Bush. Bush wasn't really thinking too deeply. He liked whatever Cheney told him, apparently. I mean, I'm assuming here. Cheney was running things, and this is what he wanted to do. So the neocons in 2002, 2003 had top cover in the administration, political top cover. And so it made it a little bit easier for what they were trying to do. And the strange thing and the worrisome thing is Donald Trump, at least in his campaign rhetoric, and where his support comes from in the country. It's a kind of a swath of independents and some Republicans, some Democrats. But what appealed to a lot of them, veterans, what appealed to a lot of them was he said, we're not going to go mess with foreign countries. We're going to take that money and we're going to rebuild our bridges, our schools, our infrastructure, our roads, build a wall, whatever. He's going to build at home, not over there in these places that don't understand us, don't like us, and we don't know why we're doing things. So this was his campaign mantra. It is what brought him, is what launched him. It is actually one of the few differences between him and Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton was very willing to continue the wars in the Middle East, continue Obama's wars, which were, in fact, Bush's wars. She would have done that. She said she was going to do that. Trump was the only of the Republicans, except possibly Rand Paul, who said he was going to bring troops home. And that's kind of the context of the America First. It's not that America is necessarily the best or it's going to be great again, but that our money stays home, our priorities are our American people. And American people responded to that. Now, staff surrounding Mr. Trump does not believe this, okay? John Bolton does not believe this. A number of the other folks up there don't. The so-called deep state in the foreign policy arena does not believe any of this rhetoric that Trump gave in order to get elected. So basically, they're running around him, and they're playing him It's unfortunate that he's able to be played, but, you know, here's a print. Now, look, you could compare him to Bush. I mean, you know, what did Bush ever say that he believed? I don't know. I don't recall. Nothing really stands out. I think he ran on a non-interventionist foreign policy as well, but he didn't really believe it. But Trump is very communicative about what he thinks and what he, you know, how forcefully is, how he will fire people. And yet, even for all of that, we're seeing the same crowd running the same kind of roughshod over the, you know, the American people, pushing us into wars that we can't win and will cost us for years and years into the future for no reason other than they want these wars. And we could have a whole other show on why the neoconservatives are so enamored of increased involvement in the Middle East and toppling dictators and taking over countries. Why they want to do that is a whole other story.
Well, let's definitely plan to do that. But with your saying that, one of the questions I have, and this relates to Bob Woodward's book as well as the anonymous piece that was in the New York Times, and I don't want to get into the credibility of any of that, but both of those things stimulated this question to me. It seems as though with Trump coming in talking about ending war and understanding that the neocons want to continue war, this really seemed to be an internal battle more so over process than over ideology. Is that fair to say? That we're looking at the elites who want to, and that they couldn't figure out if they could trust Donald Trump to carry out their interests.
I think that's true. And in fact, I think one of the elite's opposition and horror when Trump was elected was a huge shock, and it was unacceptable because they weren't sure they could control him. The anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, you know, indicates, well, you know, I'm one of the good guys, and we're trying to keep Trump in a, you know, on track and out of the ruts, and we're controlling him the best we can. Don't you love us? In fact, that's not what the American people love. We elected them to keep us out of war, not to promote war. But one of the another similarity is mainstream media in this country, New York Times, Washington Post, they support the neocon foreign policy agenda, which is war in the Middle East, certainly, and toppling governments that we don't like around the world always. That is what they like. So I think if we learn nothing, we can learn that the mainstream media has not changed. They are the same supporters of war policies of the elites in this country that they were in 2018. Same people, same agenda. Hadn't changed a bit.
Well, in fact, you mentioned the New York Times and the Washington Post. If you go to Stephen Kinzer's book, Overthrow, he lays out very clearly how throughout history since, I want to say, the 30s, American media has been used by corporate interests to create narratives. That's how we intervene in Guatemala. That's how we intervene in Venezuela.
Absolutely.
Iran in 52 with the overthrow of Mossadegh.
Absolutely. And, you know, we like this word woke, and I like it. I think it sounds great. It's kind of indicating that we're not a sheep anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, a lot of people who think they're woke aren't woke, and a lot more sheep need to be woke because that's where the real power is. The elites, the media, the storyline, the war, hooked into the business side of this. I mean, our biggest export in terms of production and even natural resources, above all of that, is war machinery, war technology, things that states use to control people, you know, in the IT world. I mean, this is what we build in this country.
The U.S. just signed a multi-billion-dollar deal with India to sell them billions of dollars of weaponry.
Sure. And you know, for Trump might say, oh, make America great again. You know, hey, I'm selling stuff. But in fact, I think even Trump has to recognize that if what you're selling is ultimately counterproductive to your own survival, if it's something that only it's only a market if you can keep that market alive, and that marketplace is war, which is hurts everybody. Ultimately, it's a dead end. I can't imagine that he thinks this is great. But I'll tell you, every new contract of military sales, every new war that can be put upon the American people through the combination of our deep stater elites and the media, all of this is money in the bank for somebody, but it's not you and me. And our kids may be the ones that ultimately pay the price, both in terms of debt and their very livelihoods, their very potential for living a free life. So, you know, it's just bad stuff, it's disappointing to see some of the similarities between then and now. It's as if we haven't learned, but in fact, I do think we have learned, because there is a lot, there's a way many more people and outlets asking the right questions and talking about this than there were in 2002. I think that's one thing that is different. Thank God for the internet, even though it's regulated, controlled, monitored, and used against people. But at the same time, at least there is that opportunity for people to learn and think.
But does it matter now where the questions or what elements of the media are asking the questions? And the reason I ask that is because we're not hearing this on MSNBC. One would think, for example, that Rachel Maddow, for as liberal as she's supposed to be,
you would think,
would be screaming about this. We would think that Joanne Reed would be screaming about this. But they don't.
And the leaders of the Democratic Party in the House, where they are screaming a lot about they don't like Trump for this, that, and the other thing, you know, they would like to impeach him, and that's interesting and fun, but they're not saying a word about any of this stuff. And so, but that's because we don't really have the kind of republic or the kind of democracy that most Americans think we have in this country. We really don't have that. It's an oligarchy, and it's kind of a capitalist, I don't want to say fascist because it's not really fascist, but the money runs.
Quickly, why do you say not fascist? Because there are so many who believe we are on the verge of fascism.
I call it proto-fascism.
Oh, okay.
I do think we're there. I think we're in a pre-fascist state, and it wouldn't take too many things to have it. I mean, fascism, in the taking control of the economic arms of society, they do a lot of that, and we see a lot of that. Mussolini would say the government would be directing those companies. And what we're seeing is the companies themselves
direct the government. Right. Gotcha.
Which is a little variation. You know, I mean, it's maybe they're all the same people. I don't know. But, you know, there's a little variation. But, yeah, we're certainly in a proto-fascist state. And I think the nature of surveillance controls, the militarization of police in our own country, the government has quite a bit of potential if it decides to go full fascist at any given time, or let's just say
if it sees
martial law, it can do it.
There we go.
It can do it, and it used to not be able to do it, but it every day brings us a little closer to it. And
some would argue, as my engineer is telling me, I got to wrap this up. Some would tell us that's why Donald Trump was there, to get us to the point to make it easier for the government to do it if necessary.
Yeah, I would agree with that, except for the paranoia and panic that he has caused amongst the elite itself.
Okay.
I don't think they can quite control him. But, yeah, potentially a Donald Trump figure is part of that, sure.
Okay.
A Donald Trump-type populist figure is a key part of it. But, anyway, I'm trying to keep my fingers crossed.
Thank you.
Yeah, concerning time.
Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force retired, Karen Kwiatkowski, thank you so much for your time. This was like old home week.
I know. It's great talking to you. Really great.
And I look forward to getting you back on the show, Karen. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, folks, that right there gives you an awful lot to think about. The woman who was there, one of the women who was there in the Office of Special Plans as this data was being manipulated, and telling you some of the people who were involved in the process at the time, and they're still there. Wow. Well, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.